the faith is only stuff is intended to be buried, and we got into the issue of whether you can publish people's letters after their death, right, posthumously. And now I'll go shift gears a little here to the bottom, page 4 of the handout. The bottom of page 4 is an interesting issue which is related, although perhaps not directly looking for the standard of Bein HaGershom, but it seems to fall in that category as well. It says here, Din Iyun B'Yoman HaZulas Peresari Alex, Din Iyun B'Yoman HaZulas HaKushubim Matin Tuliyim. You want to read the diary of somebody who is suspected of criminal acts. Are you allowed to open his diary and read his diary, or her diary, to open and read his diary and see what's inside it? So Rabbi Halevi writes, from the 26th of Shvat 1984, I read you up here, I want to clarify, he any ro'eh, assume that I don't see any difference between the Dolich Tachov, between the issue of your letter, they must put that to you, but Shuvah, by saying the Chalav, and that which I wrote in response to him in Atele Harav Tevishon Simon Mem Beis. That was the same one we saw about the boys writing the girl in the girls' institution. It's the same idea. Even Nation Talmud said Kosak Mifurash. And if it's because the fact that the student wrote on his diary, so also we call Gormir HaMusmachim Layem Yomar, that it's forbidden for all prophecies to read this diary, right? He wrote on the diary, no authority may read the diary. So that means, the fact that he wrote it doesn't make a difference. It's no more, no less than if he didn't write it. Because if it's forbidden, it's forbidden whether he wrote it or not. And if it's permitted, it's permitted whether he wrote it or not. You don't agree necessarily to his condition just by the fact that he wrote it there. So therefore he says, since it's forbidden, nonetheless, it doesn't matter whether he wrote it. In the time of the tshuva, but, and if we said there it's permitted despite the apparent prohibition of paying Rabbi Meir Gershom, so here still, Dinu Shem Mutar Gam Kan, should also be permissible here. Now it's interesting because what he's saying is he's extending Rabbi Halevi, Chayim Rabbi Meir Gershom, from letters, which is the explicit language in the initial Takana, the initial decree, that you now must read your friend's letters, to other things upon which you place a seal of privacy, for example, on your diary, right? An extension, it's not a logical extension, it's a very logical extension, but it is an extension of what the original decree was. So he says it does apply here as well. El Shabdel HaKadi says this is what you now get in this case. Shasham Haya, there was, I saw he's got Bruce Bielke between, there was an improper correspondence between a girl and a boy. That's upper Pasura Smo, and that shows, no, this is something which is should be rejected in and of itself. So what about a T-Base class? We just want to know what's going on in the correspondence, but the correspondence itself was forbidden. So therefore, there's reason for suspicion, because they're involved in something which, at least from the school's perspective, is an illicit relationship. However, even though I suggested to stop the correspondence, Even if it's possible, believe it's called the command without reading the letters. However, here, it's also said, you write, a student is suspected in being involved in negative activities. These suspicions were sealed by faith, you want to sustain based on looking in his diary. The second really our student should be a place. Says it's forbidden to do so. Shekain Esama Khashad in Omutar, what right you have to have the suspicion? Who gave you the right to have the suspicion that then you should be allowed to confirm your suspicion by looking in the diary? Over there, there were of course a boy and girl writing to each other. Okay, that in itself is clearly a big flag. It's not just a suspicion, there's something bad going on. But here, there's nothing bad going on, it's just your suspicion, and you want to corroborate your suspicion by going to the diary, who says it's permissible? The Chaim definitely says, Yesh Baruch Hashanah, it's necessary initially, the Vatesh Shachin Kami Matim Shalim to provide basis for the assumption that there aren't these negative things going on. Then, if that suspicion is verified by other investigations, in order to rectify the situation, your Yem Musar Achartach Layem Yomar will be permissible afterwards, to look into the diary. I have a lonely says here, you'll be a mommy's nechashot. But we will not permit somebody to look in the diary just because he's suspicious. It's a very powerful statement, what she's making. In other words, really, you can't look at somebody's diary if you suspect that they're doing bad things, because it's their private intellectual property. And I think that this Tanya Rabbeinu Gershom, the way I understand it, is the initial basis for the concept of intellectual property within Jewish law. In other words, beforehand, it's very hard to point that somewhere in the Gemara. You know, we talk about damage, which is caused by looking at somebody, looking at his private things, but that's not really involving intellectual property. It's involving his use of his yard, right? Whether he has the capacity to use his yard or not use his yard. But here, what you're saying is that if I write something down, record something in some way, you are not permitted to access that thing unless I give you permission to do so. And that all comes from Chen Rabbeinu Gershom, which prohibits somebody reading somebody else's correspondence. So again, if it's not for Chen Rabbeinu Gershom, I don't know if there would be such a thing as intellectual ownership. The thoughts are words. You can't own my right to read the words, but here, Rabbeinu Gershom introduced the concept of ownership of words. I have an ownership over these words, and I can bar access to you even without putting them on the lock and key. So by virtue of the fact that I wrote them, and they're my personal diary and my personal letter, you are not then permitted to go and read what I wrote. And the same thing would be true about any other form of communication. In other words, if you have you wrote a letter, emailed to somebody, and there are other people who live in that house, and other people work in that office, it would seem that those other people are not allowed to read that email unless they stipulate ahead of time, unless let's say a company stipulates with its employees that any email which comes into the company mailbox or inbox or whatever computer server is going to be read. So then, of course, you agree to be employed there under those conditions. But if they didn't stipulate that ahead of time, they really have no right to read things that you receive which are meant to be private. Which I've been able to introduce, but that seems to be the case. There should, however, be one exception, at least one exception. If you send to the next page, take a look at page 5. So here, there was stuff on the page before, which I just wrote over by hand because it wasn't worthwhile copying the whole page for about 10 words. So this is an interesting issue, which exists in Encyclopedia Talmudic, taken from the Gemara itself, the concept of Rushei Nisua, separating somebody from doing a prohibition. This is a chiyuv, you see my handwriting writing on the right, it's a chiyuv, a requirement, minoach haveiro milasot bar nisua, to prevent your friend from doing something bad. In other words, if I see you walking into McDonald's and ordering a cheeseburger, I am required to physically subdue you and remove you from the premises. Right? Really? Yes. Because I have to, it's an obligation upon me to separate you from doing this prohibition. All Jews are responsible for one another. In theory, you know, if I should, any Jew, not just you, who are all great, very pious people, but if I see anybody who walks into McDonald's and I assume that, and they're not ordering coffee or Coke, but they're ordering something more substantial, so then, yes, I should can bodily remove them from the premises.
Can you stop us from entering McDonald's if you don't know yet what we're going to purchase?
No, I can't do that, right, because you might be going there to get a coffee or a Coke, so that's okay.
You're permissible to buy a coffee or a Coke.
Absolutely. I shouldn't be prohibited. We don't make those things up. If they don't say so in the postscript, we don't have to make them up. I mean, you might feel comfortable going to McDonald's. Most Orthodox Jews would certainly feel uncomfortable walking to McDonald's and ordering a coffee. But
to a rabbi, probably wouldn't, because you have a job.
Well, no,
if you're a rabbi sitting at McDonald's, you get coffee.
I have to say, very often when you're traveling, you know, there's service areas, so the concession stands or McDonald's or Wendy's or something like that. So it's very infrequently we actually come across a Starbucks in a service area.
Starbucks is kosher.
Coffee?
Just coffee is kosher.
Yeah. Most coffee doesn't need a hasher. By the way, most of the flavors are kosher.
Uh-huh.
I mean the pump, you know, pump flavors, you know, the stuff they pump into your coffee.
The
ones that they sell in the stand itself, right? Yeah. What? The coffee that they sell in the bottles already,
like... Oh, that I don't know. I think some of them are OU and some don't, so I don't know about that. You know, there is a Starbucks nearby, and I frequent it on many occasions. and I never see a really religious-looking person sitting.
You haven't been there when I got there. I mean, maybe I don't look really religious.
I mean,
that might be the case.
Black coat, black hat, black teeth.
They usually don't sit there, but they go in and take stuff out. To sit in Starbucks means, you know, you're going to sit there with your laptop on your wireless network, you know, doing some work.
You have a wireless company?
Yeah, the Starbucks with a wireless network, yeah. So I mean, it's not really something which they're most unless you have a business meeting or something. But some of the cakes are kosher, but you really can't know.
Some of them are.
You have to ask to look at the box. Some of the bagels are kosher. But so you have to go look in the box.
Will I ever see Rabbi Shore sitting in a Starbucks?
Really?
No. I mean, ask him. Maybe he'll convince him. You invite him to go with you to Starbucks. Maybe that'll be an incentive for him to go with you and spend some time shooting.
Maybe the Shiva lets you come with him.
So I'm reading Yiddish guys unless you come to the Starbucks. Try that, see what happens. So in any event, there is a minority view in halacha that coffee is forbidden when it is made by a non-Jew, like other forms of cooking. In other words, you're not allowed to eat something which is cooked by a non-Jew, unless a Jew started the fire, you know, turned on the flame. Even if it's under supervision, even if it's kosher, unless it's something which could be eaten raw, or something which actually is not considered to be significant, like potato chips or something like that, which is the parameter that the rabbis gave us has to be olal shulchan malachim, has to be something which people would serve at a formal dinner. So something which is not like that, so bishulach and the problem of going cooking would not apply.
You said something that could be eaten raw. Does that mean that a baked apple is okay because it could have been eaten raw originally?
Right.
So
well, cooked carrots.
Chocolate-covered coffee beans.
They're not real coffee beans.
They're not real coffee beans.
The point is, the reason why most postings, the overwhelming majority of postings allow coffee is because it's water. It's water with flavoring. What you get is you get water. It's water which went through coffee or filter, you know, which has been gone through a filter which is coffee, but what you get is water. That's why the bruch on it is, what bruch do you guys make on coffee? Chocolate. Where to be actually the coffee to be considered the status of the bean, what bruch would you make on coffee? No.
Eight.
Coffee bean grows on trees.
Yes, sir.
Coffee, chocolate. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes that for 40 years he's been trying to figure out why people make shahakal on chocolate bars, and he hasn't been able to figure it out.
Because it comes from a tree.
Chocolate bars?
Yes.
What have you been saying?
I said shahakal.
Everybody says shahakal, but Shlomo Zalman says he doesn't know why.
Could it be like with the same thing with peanut butter, where you consider charcoal?
Yes, the process of chocolate.
Like where you can't recognize it as coming from the
chocolate. No, but the point is, chocolate is you don't eat any other way than a chocolate bar. Something where there's some primary way of eating it, and now it's a process beyond recognition. So then you make taka charcoal.
Right.
But chocolate, nobody eats raw chocolate beans, right? Cocoa beans.
Chocolate-covered cocoa
beans. Except for you. You eat the chocolate-covered coffee beans and cocoa beans. But us, normal people, so we don't actually eat that kind of stuff. So therefore, for us, the primary way in which you eat chocolate is from a chocolate bar. So therefore, you said you should make all eight on a chocolate bar. The only rationale Nasu, which he doesn't like, is to say that the primary ingredient in chocolate bar is sugar. So therefore, since it's
primary
what?
Semi-sweet chocolate.
Right, it doesn't really work in all chocolate bars, especially if it's not well, mostly it's not even semi-sweet, though.
For dark chocolate.
It is sweet chocolate. I think there's a lot of sugar.
There's a lot of dark chocolate.
I think they also have a lot of sugar. They just don't have milk.
Dark chocolate.
You know much sugar?
Dark chocolate has not a lot of sugar.
Not a lot of sugar?
No.
Okay, so then I wouldn't... So then that taka wouldn't work for that in any event, but the truth is that even regular, you know, milk chocolate, the primary ingredient for which you're eating is not the sugar, then you take raw sugar. primary reason we're eating is the chocolate, so therefore he says he doesn't know why good people don't make ice on chocolate bars.
Does he make
I'm sure Shlomo Zalman didn't have chocolate bars.
Yeah, like chocolate frosting.
I once had a friend who was a student with me at the same time. He was a little younger than I. Was a Talmud in Shalvim, a yeshiva in Israel at the same time I was there. And he once went to one of the Rebbeim before he left back to America. He went up to the one of the Rebbeim and asked him, the guy who was born in Yerushalayim, lived on the whole life in Yerushalayim, very holy fellow. But he asked him, is it permissible to eat steak? America, it's a very pressing question.
Why not?
Hedonism.
What?
Out of hedonism, is it too big a luxury to eat steak? That was his question.
Too big a luxury?
This is the question here.
Burn the steak.
Okay, so he asked, is it permissible to eat steak? So this Rebbe answered back completely innocently. He said, what is a steak? He had no clue what a steak was. So, necessarily right neighborhood, you might never come across a steak in your entire life. So it's quite likely you won't come across a steak in your entire life. So many other ones as well. So the chocolate bar, I don't know how many chocolate bars Shlomo Zalman had in the course of his life. Maybe it's the one or two chocolate bars he had, even that much. He ate an apple first in order to make ice and drank a cup of water in order to make a shako, and that covered all bases and then ate the chocolate bar. That would work, right?
Yeah.
So maybe that's how we handle the situation. I don't know.
I'm
going
to be every time I eat chocolate.
Is it?
Why
I know what they put it in, right?
Sugar
and lactose. No, there must be some reason why it doesn't have asterisk. I don't know, it could be that there's some...
It used to be kosher.
Usually the reason why stuff like that is not kosher is because there's some grape stuff going on somewhere. In other words, there's a process on the same equipment as grape juice, or the grape juice and some of the versions of it, and they don't clean it out properly. That's usually the reason in that kind of stuff, like not kosher. So I imagine that that's the case.
But it's less than 1/60.
What?
It's less than 1/60. Flavoring is usually less than 1/60 of the
water. If it's made of flavor, then even if it's less than 1/60.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
If it's only the substance of the food, but not the flavor. The flavor, I don't know exactly what they're doing, but I imagine that. If you call up the OU, they'll probably tell you. 212-563-4000. Might be 5, 6, 4, 3,000. I think it's 5, 6, 3, 4,000. So,
I was interested in what kind of flavor plants are going to be. Yeah. All the bad stuff that goes in.
Ask for the cautious department. So again, getting back to coffee, and then we'll get back to this issue. And back to coffee, so there knows that Rizal, who was the great Kabbalist from Sfat, is alleged to have said that coffee has the status of Bishul Akum because it's more substance than water. In other words, unlike tea, which is really basically water, coffee has some thickness, has some substance to it after the coffee is added. I don't know exactly why the difference exists, but there is some difference. And therefore, he contended that coffee should be forbidden under Bishul Akum restrictions. But the overwhelming majority of posting, everybody else has permission to have coffee, which was made by a non-Jew. So that would permit one to go to Starbucks and have coffee in Starbucks.
What about like the hazelnut coffee, vanilla, French roast? They have different flavors of coffee.
In Starbucks, they only have non-flavored coffee beans, and you can get pumped into your cup those flavorings. They don't have actually flavored coffee. They have flavored coffee, so they need Hampshire, obviously.
But normally, if you have a vanilla nut coffee bean,
you need Hampshire.
They usually do it.
Yeah. So you don't know what's in there. But again, the Starbucks or other cafes and that sort, they don't have that. So whenever I go to Starbucks, generally speaking, I order a soy latte because it's like you call these raw, so therefore all the milk is off limits for me. That's why.
The soy milk.
They use exclusively silk soy milk, which is always kosher. Actually, I've never seen them trade soy milk. They all seem to be kosher.
But when the steaming was the thing, which has been...
They use different things. Because people are lactose intolerant, so therefore, order the soy.
They're afraid of being sued.
Right, so they do it separately.
God bless America. Everyone's so afraid of being sued.
They're both fluent. They are.
They're so afraid of being sued by the vegetarian thing. You're shipping everything.
Right.
When Starbucks does this, are they doing it with kosher rules in mind? Or they just lost
it in mind? Lawsuits.
Money.
Right.
They are
they have any of their materials that they are accessible for customers who keep classrooms, or is it just, it just happens to work out that way?
Okay.
As a marketing hack, it doesn't really matter to them, it just happened to work out.
It just happened to work out.
Cheap styrofoam. Yeah.
It has nothing to do with the kosher market. I mean, it's the primary shareholders are Jew, but and the CEO is Jewish, but it's not that firm. So it's not his concern.
You couldn't use the actual, you
know,
you get a paper cup to go,
but
you couldn't use their actual
cups. So let me tell you, once we're this far off track, that if you ever go to on a date to an upscale place and you want to order a drink, you should order in glass. Okay, even the china, it's difficult to say it's explicitly or ceramic. It's difficult to say it's prohibited because it's rare that you actually have the beverage so hot in the china that they consider to be cooking the china. And at the same time, there should be a trace beverage. It's very, very unlikely. Sometimes you pour soup into a bowl, but you usually don't pour soup into a cup. And even if you do, it's not pre-rishon. It's ready removed from the fire. It's a pre-shlishi, right? It's, you took the soup in a ladle and put it in the bowl. So therefore, it's unlikely that actually anything trade really penetrated. By that time, doesn't penetrate the wall of the china. The other possibility is that when they wash together, they wash all the dishes together. Then maybe there were dishes which had trade on them, which now are washed together with, the cups which had no trade on them, and the stuff penetrates from the trace dishes into the water, and then that goes into the china as well, and it's very hot water. But that's also unlikely, because those who say that once you introduce soap into the mixture, it's considered to destroy all the taste. There is no good taste, and therefore only good taste of traces makes something not good and not bad taste of traces. And B, it's not so at all clear that something will come from transmit from the cup of the trace plate into the water into the cup. It would have to really be that some pig, actually, or something like that, had some direct contact with the cup in order for that to be a problem. And again, that there isn't the soap in the festive taste. But all that is possible to happen with china or ceramic, and therefore you should avoid using china or ceramic. But you can use glass, because we hold in halacha that glass is non-absorbent. It doesn't have any, it's completely smooth. And therefore nothing penetrates the glass. And that's why for those for Pesach, just use glasses, the same glass you use the rest of the year, and just fill them up with water 3 times, leave them for a couple of days, and you just use them for Pesach. Because glass doesn't absorb anything. So therefore, if you want to go out, if you're out on a date, and you want to have a cup of coffee, or something of that sort, you're a trade restaurant, you want to have a cup of coffee, and you don't want to use paper for some reason, then you can have them put it in a glass. I have done that in the past.
Don't you need a clothes ceramic, though?
Only if you belong to a Jew. No, ceramics are the black episode.
You don't have to total ceramic?
Not ceramic.
What's the question? So if a Jew owns a restaurant, then you wouldn't be able to use the glass?
Right.
How would you know? You wouldn't know? Can you rely on the subject that...
You can assume that the trace is not owned by Jew, unless you know otherwise.
Well, there's a lot of secular Jews up there. So.
Yeah, okay. The majority of owners will be non-Jews.
No, I mean, just so well with the question, what
is the glass will need to be, if the cup's going to be told?
Plastic
also, right? Plastic too, yeah. China, ceramic, plastic, stoneware, none of that has to be recycled. Corel is a plastic.
Corel.
Which is
metal?
It's not quite glass. I'm sorry, not corel, Pyrex. Pyrex is not quite glass, not quite ceramic.
Right.
So we do recycle Pyrex.
I don't know
what to do. When you grow up, you'll find out.
Metal can't be done. Metal can't be
done. Yeah.
You
thought
I'd
break something
out. I don't know.
There's a difference between koshering and titling. Koshering, you can't kosher ceramic.
No.
Not ceramic because you have to train.
But I'm pirate
either. Right. Can't kosher. Well, we have to be strict about all these things. Although, if it really was something very, very expensive, and you left it and hadn't used it for 12 months, just left it for 12 months, then there are those who renew it after 12 months.
For 12 months or 3 years? My mom just did all the kitchen kosher things that she...
12 months.
Yeah.
It has to be like if you had, let's say, China, which was used for trade.
Right.
But now it's been 12 months since it's been used, and it's very expensive to China, so you don't want to pick it up. Then you can use it for kosher afterwards.
Okay.
As long as it's completely clean and it's been around. But generally speaking, most ceramics you can't kosher. There's a separate halacha which says that if whether something is kosher or not kosher, a new vessel, which you buy from a non-Jew or non-Jewish store, you have to put into a mikveh before you use
right.
it. That's what we're talking about. Not making something which was trade kosher, but rather taking something which was not trade but belonged to a non-Jew and putting it into a mikveh. So you only have to do that if you own the thing, or if a Jew owns it. But if you go into a store which is owned, or a restaurant which is owned by a non-Jew, and you order something in glass, the fact that he hasn't labeled it, that's not a problem for you, because he owns it and not you, then you can use it.
You can put it on the smell, right?
You can put it on the smell, yeah, but it has to all be connected. And this smell, you can put it on, it has to be 40 of snow in one place.
Let's see what?
40 of snow. About 120 gallons.
Of snow would define one place.
Yeah, that's not connected. Like back there, I'm sure you can put it on that snowbank back there. And the one over here in front, I'm not so sure how big it actually is.
So who
needs to purify or need to put it in the mixer? Well, means to put something in the mixer. Kabal means something was went through the mixer. Okay? So that's just like that. So yeah, you ask your question for table snow too, but it's pretty difficult to do.
So you can use snow as a mixer?
Yeah.
You jump into a snowbank?
If you jump in the snowbank and you cover yourself with snow, bear in mind you have nothing on,
right.
Then you have fulfilled the obligation.
That's interesting.
Yes.
Now, in terms of a mikveh, it's a natural collection of water, right? So, I know for mikveh they always use super thick.
No, it's not supposed to flow.
Right.
A mikveh doesn't flow.
Super thick concrete they use because it can't leak, right?
Right.
So, what if you had like a waterproof bowl that you left out in the rain and it filled up with water? Can you toy bowl in that?
No, it has to be connected to the ground. The water can't be in a vessel, it has to be in the ground.
And so concrete, which is
to the ground. Right. So you can't have a mikveh any vessel of any
sort. So you can have a concrete bowl in the ground.
Yeah.
Not supposed to flow. Rainwater only makes things pure if it's stationary. Water which comes from a spring is considered to be of a higher level in halacha. That can make something you can play with rain spring water even if it's moving. But rainwater has to be absolutely still, and that's supposed to mix them. This is a gathering of water, a pool, so it can't be flowing at all.
I've seen mixes where there's rain drains that flow into it.
From flowing in is fine, it can't flow out.
Right.
But doesn't it have to...
Is that circulate?
Yeah.
Oh, why?
Well, because...
You don't actually tidal when you go to the mixer. Have you ever been to a mixer? You don't actually tidal in the rainwater.
Right.
No.
What?
Yeah.
The rainwater
but there's always intercirculating.
Not the rainwater. No. The rainwater usually the way the mikveh works.
It's like
a big pool. The way the mikveh works. Trust me, it didn't go where the rainwater is. The way the mikveh works is one of two ways nowadays. Actually, we incorporate usually several chumas in the mikveh. But the way the mikveh works is that this is over here. Is the rainwater. And over here there's a hole between these two containers, which is the size of a fist. You can add two fingers as a minimum, but usually the size of a fist. And over here you put city water.
With bromine.
With chloride, with whatever you need to put in there. So this actually is the water you're totaling.
Right.
The reason why it's good as a mixer is because it's connected to the rainwater. This rainwater over here is never changed. So the moment it be changed, the mixer will no longer be good. So, you know, theoretically, there's overflow, so I imagine there's some way of practicing of taking off the overflow. But here you have to have the 40 of rainwater, and it's much flow. This is what causes it to be kosher. If you were to seal this hole, so then the mixer will no longer be good, because you're settling in the water, which is only a mixer by virtue of an attachment to that. There's a difference between non-Lubavitch mikvahs and Lubavitch mikvahs.
They do it on the bottom.
Lubavitch means Lubavitch do it on the bottom like this, right?
And they
put the rainwater. Many modern mikvahs use both systems. They have how they use both systems. They have they have in this system, they use them side, but they have one on top of the other.
In other words, there's two rainwater things,
rain here and rain there. Why do they do it that way?
Because
there is sloshing back and forth between the two pools. According to most posting, the fact that it sloshes back and forth is not a problem, because each time a little bit of water comes in here, it's going to be nullified in the rainwater. But there are posting who hold, the minority posting, hold that if this becomes enough of this water becomes rainwater, becomes city water by sloshing back and forth, so then the whole thing will go good. What? Over kosher. So the Babbitters, in order to avoid that, one of the Babbitter rabbis came up with the idea of putting the rainwater on the bottom. So that way it doesn't slosh back and forth, because by power of gravity, the rainwater will stay below as opposed to actually sloshing up. So that was their idea. And the thing is that some posts, particularly the Hungarian world, held that that was not a connection. Because in essence, the way the connection works is by, you say I'm exaggerating the size of the wall, of the floor, but the connection is by a flow. Now, the flow might be stationary, right? But there is, technically speaking, a flow which is going from here down, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the connection. And the posts can hold that a flow, I mean, everybody holds a flow is not a connection. The question is whether you regard this case, where there's water all over the place and it's all standing still, as a flow and it's not connected, or it's not a flow and it is all connected. So obviously the Babbitters hold it's not a flow and it's all connected, whereas other folks who hold it is a flow, therefore it's not connected, and therefore they make it specifically on the side. Or then, as I said, modern day flows very often what they'll do is make two pools. They have this pool over here, which is the one below, which we assume never changes. If you open up that water, probably stinks. But then that's connected to this, right? Which in turn is connected to that.
So you would never be able to access the bottom one because it's sort of underneath other
things. Yeah, you'd never be able to access it. I don't know how they...
So they fill it up the first time, and then they fill up, and it just never changes.
Right.
So for the above-ish ones, what they do, I guess they would just have the rainwater go in at first until it reaches up to the top, and then put in city water.
Yeah, after the mix is built, there's a certain amount of time we can't use it. Until actually enough rain has collected to
right.
So make it work.
But then would they ever have to do new rain, like empty it all out and do it again, ever?
No. They wouldn't have to. If they would, then they would have to have a spare pool, because they can't not have a pool function, at least one pool functioning, otherwise they lose the mix and they have to start from scratch again.
Start from scratch.
If you drain this, right, and you have a backup pool, you have to wait till it rained already and rained enough to get that pool again.
Right.
So you don't do that.
Snow.
What?
Collect a bunch of this snow and just put it in the
river. Yes.
I thought it has to be a natural pool.
Yeah, it's natural. The thing is that normally you can't transport water, because when you transport water, by definition, you're putting it into a vessel, and a vessel is no good. But I'm not sure snow works, but a block of ice does work theoretically. If you took a block, you actually able to freeze a mikveh in place, and I think people have done this. Freeze the mikveh in place and transfer it that way from place to place, that would be okay.
Oh, because you're not
putting
the
vessel,
you're
holding it up, right.
So snow would work too, unless your hands are a vessel.
What? Yeah, sometimes. If you compact it enough, it would be okay, but I'm not sure. I think maybe in picking it up would be a problem. I think it's not just the vessel, so idea of being connected to picking it up, so I think you actually would have to freeze it in place in order for it actually to work.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Rabbi, the one phrase you used that caught my ear was that there's collected rainwater, and if they open it up, you might discern that it stinks. That's literally the case. They have stagnant rainwater collecting for long periods of time that you immerse yourself in.
No, you don't immerse yourself in it.
You immerse yourself in the chlorine.
You immerse yourself in the city water, but the stagnant rainwater is added to that.
No.
So it's connected.
Connected to it. But it's not. But it's a theoretical.
Don't put your hand in that hole, right? What happens is if you put your hand into that hole, if you go to the mikveh, and you put your hand into the hole which connects the rainwater with the water where you are, now you will pull in a bunch of sediment, which will settle there over time. But in fact...
Don't put your hand in the hole. Stay on the other side.
I have to say, it's such a pleasure to shock you because your face is so expressive. If you don't actually put your hand in there so the water more or less stays separate, it's just a locking connection, not that there's necessarily flow back and forth. That's the way it works.
All right.
As experience of countless mikvahs, I just heard that that's the way it works.
All right.
And it's clear anywhere you are, so it's
clear anywhere. And the reason you have the attachment to the rainwater is because
it's the rainwater which makes you pure, not the city water.
The filthy water that makes you pure.
Right.
Okay.
You can take a mix out of mud too.
Right.
One question:
it's not clean. It's pure.
How is the lake considered a mikveh?
It's mostly came there by rain or by the spring fresh.
But it's flowing though.
No, a lake is not flowing. It's stationary.
Definition of a lake.
Yeah, it's larger.
A river is flowing.
Yeah.
So can you mikveh in a river? You can mikveh in a river though.
It depends what it's from. If it's from rainwater, it's no good. If it's from spring fresh, it is good.
Everything's from rainwater eventually.
No.
No.
Once it goes to the ground.
Spring water is on the ground.
Spring water comes from the ground.
Where
most
that water comes from the rain.
Most rivers originate from springs.
Right.
The problem is that then there's a lot of snow melt and runoff, which is rain. So in fact, Mara says there are certain the rivers in, I think, Iraq, you could go to the mikveh in them in the winter, but not in the summer. Because in the winter,
it melts, right?
In the summer, it's snow melts, whereas in the winter, oh, that's what they used to do. Have to do, no, they first topnik votes. We're going to have to come back to the other things.
Yeah, sure.
The first topnik votes were introduced in the 17th century. At that time, it was considered to be a tremendously novel idea, which attracted a lot of opposition. Because originally in the 17th century, it was 18th century. Originally, the way a mikveh was, how would a town have a mikveh? They weren't really usually sophisticated enough to collect rainwater and make a pool and a pool next to it.
Like Masada. Masada has a mikveh.
That's a more sophisticated mikveh. The way they used to do it in the old days is actually, they used to dig down deep enough underground so they reach the water level, right? So let's say this is the surface, right? Look at this down here. There's the
wait,
what? The kiln?
Yeah, the kiln.
Oh, so that's like a spring, yeah. Well, right? And then they would make a little platform inside, and the women would, or men would,
jump on, climb down the ladders?
Climb down the ladders or the mikveh, and that was very, very cold, right? So that's
freezing,
I've got. Yeah, it's like Carrizal's mikveh in the spot. So that is very, very cold. So along came, I think it was the first Kabbalist Rebbe came up with this idea, which is that they put like slats, and they made slats over here. And on top of the slats, let's say the water level is down here, right? So on top of the slats, they poured hot water, or warm water. So that way, when the woman was playing, so she was playing in this area over here where the water was more or less warm, right? At least for a while. And then afterwards, they actually, the way mikvahs are now today, so of course, they don't need, we no longer have this type of connection. Now, of course, this water is always heated. But back then, that was the idea to pour hot water into the mikveh at the time. And it's a big issue because the hot water is mixing with the cold water. It's not mixing with the cold water, but
not mixing with the cold water. How do you heat it up? Excuse me? Like you put hot water, it'd be hot for that time, but then the next time you have to put more hot water.
It's not more hot water.
So wouldn't it make it deeper and deeper and you have to keep raising the pot?
No, the water level doesn't.
The water level
doesn't change.
No, the water level is ground.
It doesn't change much.
It's the aquifer from the ground. It's not a...
No, but if you poured water into it and made it deeper.
Yeah, but that doesn't really influence how much water.
Yeah, it's fed down on the ground.
Yeah.
What they used to do is in the Gemara, it says in Sefer Yuma, the time that when the Kohen Gadol used to have to go to the mikvah on Yom Kippur, it was cold, and it was an open-air mikveh in the Beis HaMikdash. What they used to do is they used to heat up large metal slugs, and used to put those in the water, and that used to heat up the water. What?
You can put large metal hot slugs into the water of a mikveh?
Yeah.
Sorry.
What?
Everything.
All kinds of little lock, stop, and barrel. Yes.
Can you be wearing, like, a towel?
No, you could actually if it's loose enough that the water will penetrate under it. But
sometimes the bathing suits even like
it. Yeah, but it's not elastic. If it has elastic that creates problems.
Right. But as long as all of you is
getting
that. So if you're wearing elastic, couldn't you like just put your finger around? Like,
yeah, you could. If you're going swimming in the ocean.
Because I think mikveh in the ocean. The only mikveh I've ever been to is the Pacific Ocean.
That works.
Let's assume that you're in a place like Oregon.
And that will be excited from holding other people's mail.
Yes. Like Oregon, you have lots of rain continuously. Are there mikvehs there that have what we see are more palatable exchange of rainwater on a more regular basis, so you didn't have a connection with filthy rainwater.
Yes, go ahead.
So I might help. I mean, but around here, and there's a, I go to a mixer, it's not heavy.
I'm dealing with rainwater that's been sitting there weeks.
50 years.
Well, you
clean out the tanks every now and then?
They clean this house. They only clean out when they absolutely need to. And usually if they only do their spare pool, then they'll clean out more often. But every time they clean this out, particularly in a town which hasn't enough mikvahs, much is not a problem. But you go to another town which has not enough mikvahs, it's fine. You clean it out so the women can't use the mikvahs.
The rainwater has to go directly there? Can you have a rainwater storage tank and then feed new rainwater every day?
If it rains enough. When you're talking about a place where you have to assume that there's going to be enough rain.
Wait, when they clean out that...
Even the system is worth that way.
All right. When they clean that out, do they close the hole and then clean it out and then open the hole again?
Yeah. Which when they clean this out?
Yeah.
Yeah, they plug up the hole.
They can do that.
Yeah. Except that's because the mikvah never has a drain. Because the drain could make a leak, right? Nowadays, modern mikvahs, there are no drains. So they all, in order to clean them, they'll use suction vacuums. Mm-hmm. They suction out the water with this vacuum, and then they clean the inside. What?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you go mostly to the mikvah, you go to a place I go every Friday, Stanislav. It's pretty nasty.
He gets a shower right afterwards, right?
I take a shower. I take a shower before I go in and after I come out. Yes,
well, you have to. Before you go in, you have to.
Of course, yeah, I take it before I go in. Although many people don't.
They
should.
And for the women, they have to be completely...
Yeah, for women, they're not supposed to take a shower afterwards. While they're supposed to make a...
Why can't they take a shower?
Because it's a special decree. They shouldn't think the shower makes them sore. But women's mikvahs are much cleaner than
I know.
Their tits are in beautiful condition.
We don't use the same mikvah today. No, I mean, I'll give it a lot.
They would never let you use the same mikvah. They don't want to swim the same mikvah.
So we get the really filthy
mikvah. Yeah. I mean, Israel, there's one mikvah with...
There's discrimination.
Where there's like a wall, and on one side is the woman's mikvah, and on one side is the man's mikvah. And on the man's mikvah, there's towels and like, all sorts of stuff. All of this looks dirty, it smells, and then you go to the women's side, and it's perfectly crystal clean and nice.
Yeah, the usual... Same thing matters, they usually make women's mikvahs. It's not Israel always, but the women's mikvahs are like state-of-the-art.
Oh, yeah.
What? It's interesting. There was a fellow by the name of Rabbi David Miller, who was a rabbi in San Francisco in the 1930s, somewhere down in California, in San Francisco. And he wrote a book called The Secret of the Jew, which is full of models for how to construct a mikvah in your own home. In other words, how to turn your bathtub into a mikvah, how to make a mikvah behind a console in your living room. He has like... how to build a mikvah to the furniture. So did anybody ever actually follow through on these plans? I doubt it. But usually you'll find the mikvahs in private homes in the house of Hasidic rabbis.
What's the book called?
Secret of the Jew.
Secret of the Jew?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't want to be late.
That's okay. Anyway, so let's talk about opening other people's mail.